Welcome to Season 10, Episode 8 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we discuss role-playing military groups. Again, welcome to Season 10, Episode 8 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this episode is Chris. Welcome, Chris.
Greetings and salutations.
It's been a wonderful 2 weeks. Hopefully the problems that we had with the last episode will not resurface again.
Indeed.
So I'm kind of upset about that. But luckily, the listeners will let us know. No one has really commented too much, hopefully we salvaged, I would say, a good 90% of that episode. There was just a little bit in the Kickstarters that kind of didn't get salvaged. And I apologize for that. That was my fault. I unfortunately did not delete all the files off my digital audio recorder, and it stopped when it was full. So what can you do, right?
Indeed. Honestly, if you're, going to leave a voice comment about that, we'll play it on the thing.
Yeah. Well, luckily, I deleted everything off the voice recorder for this episode, so it has a whole full 16 gigabytes of raw audio, which, honestly, is like 6 episodes worth for us, I think. 4 or 5. Well, maybe at least 4 or 5.
Oh, yes.
So, plenty of space, people.
Mm-hmm.
It just, unfortunately, with the raw audio, it's... people don't realize this, they only see like a 60-70 megabyte file for the end audio, but the raw audio is about 1.6, 1.7 gigs.
Yeah, well, again, like compression, it takes a lot to shrink it down to put it mildly. So, we kind of live in a era that the compression is actually possible, because and paradoxically your hard drives are getting bigger, so it's kind of a fun combination.
That it is. And as you mentioned before the show, we need to wish Paul a happy birthday, belated birthday.
Absolutely.
He is not able to make it this episode, but that's okay. Happy birthday, Paul, and we hope that you had a good one over the weekend.
Indeed.
Actually, the irony is actually today that the recording is actually my brother's birthday.
Oh, sweet.
So he does not play role-playing games by any shape, way, or form.
Okay.
But that's okay. Yeah, he's an interesting cat. He does a lot of things. I don't know how to just quite describe him. He was alive and a teenager during the 70s, so he kind of was really into the punk rock movement that happened in the United States at one point.
Around?
What was that?
So the classics like the Sex Pistols or Jello Biafra.
Right. And definitely music is his thing. He lost his album collection in his previous marriage, unfortunately, but he used to have a huge album collection.
Yikes.
So. We do have one bit of sad news. At least I think it's a little sad. I mean, it's understandable, but it's a little sad. And it's kind of going in with our military theme. News is, of course, that Arleigh Emery died.
Youch. Yeah, I heard about that.
If nothing else, when people think of U.S. Marines, they think of him. I don't know anyone that doesn't.
Well, dude, Full Metal Jacket was such an amazing movie. And then he basically got the chance to play just about everybody, that same character over and over again, because he really was that character.
I think it's more of a persona than anything else. He was not that character per se.
Okay.
But he definitely was a drill instructor in the Marine Corps, and he was honorarily given advancement to gunnery sergeant because of that, everything that he did, because the Marine Corps recognized that, people think when they think the Marine Corps, they think of him. And unfortunately, he passed. He was 74.
He's had a good life, It'd be a lot worse.
You know what? Anyone who survived Vietnam at all is living a charmed life, I believe.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with you there, because... well, let's just say, it was a dirty war.
Yeah. But that said, we're going to actually talk about the fantasy versions of that, aren't we, in a way? So, anything else before we hit right into the topic?
There probably is, but darn if I can remember it right now, so let's do it.
All right, let's start. This is, I think we've touched base a little bit on this topic before. I know we have, but it's always a good talk because so many games suggest a military hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
It's implied. I mean, just off the top of my head, you know, before Palladium Games lost their Robotech license, I mean, let's face it, the Robotech setting, that was a military setting.
Yeah.
I mean, the only one that was slightly different was the Invid Invasion portion of that. And in some ways, that's why I always thought the Invid Invasion was more playable, is because of the lack of the military stuff.
Indeed. You know,
people could be military, but they have to be civilians with military gear.
Exactly.
So,
well, again, when you deal with a military-type campaign, the first thing you do is you find out whether or not you're better have a rule zero on that one to see how well you guys can follow orders and how much freedom you're going to have. Because, well, there's a lot of moving parts when it comes to a military campaign when you think about it. Some of the things include but are not limited to how big the scale. Are you playing like Black Ops behind the scenes, or are you actually going to be involved in something as nasty as, say, Passchendaele?
Yeah, I think that was one of the problems that I always had with Weird Wars 2, is I liked the idea of it, but it's like, how much do the players affect the time? You know, first off, it's a fantasy timeline, as we all know. And I think this is my problem with any of those fantasy timelines. It's like, well, how much do they diverge from actual history? You know? And where is that line? And do the players know where that line is? And, you know, can you really... I don't know. It was one of those things where I always told someone, I said, you know, I always liked the idea of playing Weird Wars 2 and then transitioning, say, from Weird Wars 2 into, like, Agents of Oblivion. Because I thought that would be a clear, you know, you fight World War II, you get into the 40s, you get into the 50s Cold War, and that kind of, you know, the players are going to end up transitioning somewhat. And I always thought that would be a good way to do that, especially since, you know, both Weird Wars 2 and Agents of Oblivion are both Savage World games. A little different, mind you, between the two, but, you know, it's still Savage World, so it's close enough that you could probably get away with that.
Yeah, and again, like, that's in one of the key questions you want to ask is, like, is how much do you want to be doing military objectives here? Because unless you have the right group, there's a good chance... I don't know. Can you say mutiny? I knew you could.
What was that?
Mutiny, because you get the right group that basically say, hey, this order keeps telling us around, and it might be for good reasons, or it might just be because the GM's being a dick. And that's when basically, what are you going to do when you somehow manage to kill your commanding officer, especially if they happen to mysteriously blow themselves up? You know, kind of just the nature of the military campaign. That's why I think it's really important to decide, well, what setting are you doing it in? Because technically you could have a military campaign as early as almost the dawn of time when you think about it, like the different eras, like especially the ancient world. Like you could be part of Roman's legions, you could be part of essentially a court medieval thing. In fact, a lot of those things are based on that stuff.
Well, I'm just thinking, I mean, you know, again, I'm going to go back to Savage World. There is Weird Wars Rome. I mean, there's a whole where you're playing members of the Roman Legion. You know, and so, and I even in D&D, you could easily run a militaristic campaign. The primary difference, of course, is that at least it's a little, you know, you would obviously expect most of the players to be probably fighters or rangers or something, some sort of fighting people. But you know, in that sort of fantasy setting, there's almost an okay to have, like, the occasional oddball. You know.
Besides, you kind of want your wizard in the game because he's basically your artillery piece.
Yeah.
You know, or the other spellcaster thereof. Or, I don't know about you, but if God's going to be on my side, I kind of want his representative there with me that has the ability to cast healing spells.
Right. But I'm just saying, that's what I mean. It's like, you know, fantasy obviously has a little bit of different connotations than I think this discussion is going to... I mean, some of the stuff still applies, obviously, but it is a little different because of that. And I'm sure other game, you know, depending on the way your game is, And I think we probably will discuss that somewhere in this episode. As you know, there is the whole, most of the players will be one thing, and then there's going to be some ancillary characters, not ancillary in terms of importance, but ancillary, you know, people that are outside that core group of the same.
Oh, absolutely. And, well, I guess you could argue that, well, do you want to set a time frame, or do you just want to bounce around in the different periods? Because, or do you want to try to go for more of a modern feel?
Let's start with the modern, because, I mean, almost anything we talk modern can be applicable, fantasy or otherwise.
Okay, then I'm going to work under the assumption that anything after the Civil War is just for the arguments of the first part. You know, the idea that you're in a modern campaign, there's a good chance it's going to be a meat grinder of some sort. Weapons are incredibly deadly to some degree. And sometimes the hard thing to do is survive.
Pretty much anything after the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, so as a result, I guess the big thing is guns. They're going to be used against you. You're going to be using them. And if you're lucky, you have, like, something ranging from a gunboat to a tank, depending on where you're actually going there. And there's a good chance that you might not have a lot of this stuff, or it might be used against you. And the trick is, like, I'll be blunt, like, the concept of covert ARPs, well, they had many different concepts, like, ranging from rangers and so forth. It's very much the idea of a commando is a World Wars concept, because basically you couldn't send crap tons of men anymore in lines in order to make sure they could actually survive the experience. And a lot of the concepts were the idea that you'd have a small group that would basically be able to duck in and duck out, you know, behind enemy's lines. And, you know, there was always saboteurs, but the British commandos, the SAS, a lot of these things, these classic military ops ended up being created in the forge of the World Wars.
And I think for most role-playing game perspectives, I think the commando ops gives at least the game master more flexibility than anything else.
Yeah, because there's only so many times you can go up to the line in a campaign before you get bored. Yeah. And more players have less game.
Yeah, you definitely have to structure a series of adventures that makes sense going to do a line. And it's not impossible. I've seen them. I don't even remember the name of the adventure, but there was definitely like a Call of Cthulhu game that was set in World War One. Mm-hmm. And granted, so, you know, you played, I think what we did is we just played, I think everyone was with the pre-gens. You just chose one of the pre-generated characters for that setting, but, you know, for that campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was very, you know, obviously, you know, as a whole, the players got, you know, separated from the rest of the unit, and then the rest of the adventures take place after that.
Agreed. Like, one of my best examples of a show to watch if you're going to try to do something in World War One, it's kind of a weird one, but it really does work. Do you know the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles?
Yes.
Well, they did, essentially, they did one episode where they were in the trenches, and then they basically had Indy and a buddy of his acting as, essentially, for lack of a better term, special force, and they kept dumping all over the place because it's still Indiana Jones, even if it's being played by a 20-year-old. And one of my favorite stories that they did took place in Africa, where they were hunting down a train that was basically an artillery piece that kept moving and disappearing, you know? And you had to take the tank out, otherwise you would never be able to take out their forces in the Dark Continent. You know, I don't know if that's offensive, so I apologize in advance, but you get the idea. So basically, you have one of these old Kaiser artillery pieces that's driving along and basically is a weapon of mass destruction. In fact, destroying artillery is often a focal point for these special ops because you got to take out the big weapon.
Well, I mean, hell, any type of artillery. I mean, during World War II, you know, the Germans were dumping a lot of money into basically what amounts to super guns.
Mm-hmm.
And let no one be fooled. Even in the modern era, people were trying to build super guns.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone's familiar with the attempt by the Iraqis to build a super gun that would hit Tel Aviv.
I remember something vaguely, but yeah, that's scary.
Yeah, it's a scary thought. I forget the guy's name that was building it, and he was just one of those people that he was a genius, but his sole focus, He didn't really care about the Iraqi politics. He just wanted someone to build his super gun. And I mean, yeah. it's kind of scary. I mean, it kind of shows you what, you know, unfortunately, what genius can do when they just want to prove their point.
Exactly.
You know, I wouldn't necessarily call the guy who built it evil. I'm sure the Israelis would disagree with that. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those things where I do believe that at a certain level, a lot of people who are geniuses operate outside the normal rules of morality. They don't really have a concept of that.
You know? Well, it's called, they have a shiny new project. They want to get it done. People keep getting in the way. They want it done. It could be the equivalent of redecorating for all it matters, you know, for them personally. Yeah. But they basically have to bug up their craw.
Yeah. But so to your point, though, artillery. I mean, let's face it. If you fast forward to Star Wars, the Death Star was the ultimate piece of artillery.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to go to the scientific, you know, science fiction era, you know, it's like, yeah. You know, I mean, in some ways, Star Wars is a classic example of a quasi-military structure almost.
Well, Star Wars is so heavily based on the concept of the French Resistance versus the Nazis, it's not even funny. You know, basically backdrop of the era, because that's essentially the same tropes. The idea that you're outgunned, outmanned, if you try to get into a straight fight with him, you're going to lose. But you got tricks, and you're smart, you know, you got these cunning little tricks, and as a result, you're going to be hard to outnumber. That's why it was all the more impressive when they finally did Rogue Run and showed you what happens when you do have enough people to actually shoot somebody. You know, but again, other typical battlefield encounters if you're using a military unit is cutting their supply lines, reinforcements. We talked about destroyed artillery, prisoner exchanges, which could be interesting. Or what if you're left behind? Maybe there was a major offensive and now you're stuck in the back of no man's land or behind enemy lines, which is a pretty standard trope.
I mean, hell, let's just take Twilight 2000. You ever play it?
I have a couple of times, but I believe you're the expert in this one.
Yeah, I mean, well, definitely from the 80s version of Twilight 2000. I mean, the basic trope was, you know, World War III ended, and it was kind of just, it ended because basically the chain of command for everyone just kind of broke down.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole purpose is that those Americans that are left, they're trying to leave and catch one of the last boats back to the United States. And of course, effectively, because the chain of command, everything's broken down, you're basically up behind enemy lines at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and, you know, it's kind of like, well, do you go, obviously, and of course there's always the infamous, you know, Red Dawn scenario where it's not quite military, but it sort of is.
Yeah, suddenly your enemies are over there. Or, you know, the Fallout universe has the same idea where basically there was a major invasion of the United States, you know, North America, by the Chinese and the Russians, and then you're basically fighting tooth and nail on your own thing. Yeah. Or if you go for alternative history things, you could do something like Castle Wolfenstein, A New Order, where the Nazis actually won. And now what? Or Men in a High Castle, which was the original story. Hmm. And, you know, like, when you're under siege and you're outgunned and out-teched, that's when you find, like, that's been a common running theme in a lot of military campaigns. Because, you know, ultimately, there's only so many PCs you can play without becoming a war game. And you, I don't know, there's a mentality in North America where you want to play the underdogs, even when you're probably outclass them, but you're outnumbered, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no. I mean, so you have another note here. Obviously, we're talking a little bit about the large and small. And I think from a playability standpoint, I think, you know, you can be in a much larger picture, but I always feel like the players should... I mean, it's going to sound a little, some people are like, well, I don't want to play players that don't have any impact, but I feel like the players should not be almost like, you know, they can alter things, but their impact is not as big as, say, you know, I built the atomic bomb and I dropped it on five cities.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a handoff between, you know, being players who are so larger than life that everything they do affects everything. To where, you know, they do affect things, but, and I think this is, I always think that this is important for things like Weird Wars 2, where it's like, you know, I want to follow a timeline, and I think they can adjust certain bits in it, but, you know, I already know that the overall arc is at some point, you know, the Allies are going to win over the Germans.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know,
And
it
unless
shouldn't.
you're playing alternate history, like, I could see why you'd want to keep the timeline straight because nothing else, then you know where to crib from.
Right. And I mean, and I think this is, I think that's the problem with some games. Like, I mean, like, I think that's why I don't like Deadlands so much, because the timeline is so skewed. It's like, I don't know, how do you crib for that? How do you really handle that? You know, you don't have what I would almost consider some of the classic Western characters at that point.
Yeah, because the Old West is a construction that happened after the U.S. Civil War.
Right, and you know,
like a lot of the tropes are built off it.
Right, you know, there's always the gunfighters that are like, you know, they're outlaws because, well, they used to fight for the Confederacy and no one would deal with them.
Yeah,
you know, where, well, I mean, you can have that, I guess, in Deadlands, but it doesn't make as much sense.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just me. I mean, I could, you know, again, and you know, it's like, you know, you have, obviously there's the whole thing about the rail barons, and it's like, yeah, you can kind of still have that, but it diverges a little too much for me. And I'm just, you know, it's like, it's hard to predict or crib that without, like, obviously, like they have, which is written like a whole bunch of supplements just to explain it all.
Yeah.
So that's just me.
Well, again, like, that's why it's important to do, if you're going to do a military campaign, to have a rules, you know, episode zero, just to figure out how hard it's going to be, or whether you guys are playing cannon fodder or big damn heroes. Like, there's a big difference playing somebody like the Duke in World War II than the cast in, like, Saving Private Ryan. Like, there's a whole different scale of metrics, what you expect weapons to do, and so forth, and whether you survive or not.
Right.
Or, you know, or again, like, you know, I'm going to always fall back when it comes to World War II on Castle Wolfenstein because, you know, it's what I grew up with. The idea of one, you know, one man wrecking crew trying to deal with other people obviously won't work well for the thing here, but.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, like, I think if you look at the classic, what I'm going to call the classic World War II movies, you have things like The Dirty Dozen.
Yes,
small,
absolutely.
Small group, effectively a commando group, or, God, what is the other movie? I can see
it. I always pick for that one is, of course, the one that basically is a bunch of Americans trying to steal a lot of crap and then end up becoming heroes because of it. Kelly's Heroes.
Oh, Kelly's Heroes. That's a classic film.
Yeah.
You know, it has Donald Sutherland playing kind of a hippie character before the hippies existed.
Yeah, it's actually kind of impressive, although it might be a little bit of hindsight stuff. You know.
You know.
You know. And
what the hell was I thinking? The Guns of Navarone, that's the other one I was
thinking. Oh, heck yeah. And if you want to go for the other side of the continent, I would throw in The Bridge on the River Kwai.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, if you want to deal with a different enemy, because although I think Nazis are some of the Pittsburgh villains in the world, you might want a little bit of variety even in a World War II campaign. Plus, there was a lot happening during that period.
Yeah. You know, to stray a little bit from the RPG topic, I think it's scary that, in general, when you look at, I think this is even the world society, is, you know, a lot of people don't realize how many people, unfortunately, during World War II, the Nazis killed.
Yeah.
And it's gotten to the point where people don't believe that there weren't that many as those people, you know, 6 million people dead, and there's a lot of people that think it was only about two.
No, dude.
And it's scary. I mean, and I understand it from the standpoint of time has passed, and it's like the newer generations are farther disconnected from the truth. And I get that. It's like, I don't know anything about the Civil War. I'm very far removed from the Civil War.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can read about it, but even what you read is tainted by what someone has decided that is true.
Yeah, like we're almost at the first generation who never even knew anybody who was of that era.
Yeah.
And it scares the absolute Helsinki out of me.
You know, I mean, and World War II is almost that way, right?
Yes.
It's at the point where, because let's just use 1941. At this point, that's 70 years ago.
Yeah. Even if you were a young whippersnapper who had there, you're a senior citizen.
Yeah.
And you weren't really involved in the thing other than telling to go there and you got lucky.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, even the people, I mean, even the Korean War is about as bad now.
Well, yeah. Well, the thing is with the Korean War, at least we have some weird zeitgeist when it comes to that sort of thing here. Even though it was basically a reskinned Vietnam War. Of course, I'm talking about MASH.
Oh, the classic MASH, yeah.
That's, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think I blew someone's mind when I explained to them that the theme song actually had words to it.
Oh, yeah, and yeah, they're not appropriate.
But it's weird. Everyone knows the TV move to the TV theme, and most people don't realize there are words to it.
Yeah, suicide is painless.
Yep.
So. And it's basically, it's not even related to the, well, I guess it is and it isn't. It kind of like, it was a reskin story, kind of like how a lot of movies that came out of there used, you know, like Run Through the Jungle or something. A song that's somewhat connected, but kind of not, although that one is very connected to the Vietnam War.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, I forget the hell I was watching recently.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, I know what it was. I was watching Hamburger Hill. And obviously, during one of the scenes, they played one of the classic, you know, I forget what the song actually was, and I apologize for that, but it was like one of those classic songs you're like, oh yeah, that's the Vietnam era, you know?
Yeah. Like,
it's weird how music can do that. And I do think that's a plus, though, in terms of for a setting, you know, if you want to have mood music for your military campaign, there's obviously, especially for the Vietnam era, there's a good chunk of music. And I even think World War II, you know, there's a lot of big band music that you can play that from the World War II era to kind of get you in the mood for that.
Heck, World War I has two songs that if they come up, you'll know you're in that era. It's A Long Way to Tipperary and Pack Your Troubles in Your Old Kit Bag.
Yeah.
You know, like music makes the feeling because you basically have that stuff here. And actually a movie like, and that's something you need to ask yourself before you start your game, because we've been talking about World War II because it's probably one of the most black and white wars we've ever had. You know, who was the good guys, who was the bad guys, who was the point there. But how much shades of gray do you want in your military conflict? Like if you do something like the Vietnam War, it's a lot more murky on which side is the good guys or the bad guys when it comes to that thing here.
Yeah.
And
I think that's why things like Tour of Darkness, they kind of get away from that because there's the war and then there's the hidden war that's happening. And I think that's the advantage of many of the weird war settings, is because there's the war and then there's the hidden war that's also happening. And it's like, you know, the players are more, end up getting more involved in the hidden war. So it almost doesn't matter what the rest of the war is doing.
Yeah, exactly. You kind of have your own story arc, which isn't going to affect the war too much, per se. And again, that's another thing you need to ask your guys, you know, before you start, is how weird do you want to make it? Like, let's say you want to do a superheroes campaign in the 60s, aka the X-Men, you know, First Class / Days of Future Past.
Or hell, let's stick with World War II. I mean, what if you want to do, like, the original Captain America?
Yeah,
you know, that would
be something else, because again, there's one of the great things about Nazis, they had so many crazy experiments that a lot of them didn't pan out, but in your world they could have. Like, what happens if you crawl across a hill and suddenly you see a rat, which makes them, okay, you know what a mouse is? It was a German tank experiment to build a really big tank, for lack of a better term. Somebody drew one that was three times its size, which is basically a crawling fortress known as a rat, RATTE. Or what if, you know, all those crazy, you know, occult knowledge that they used, what if it's based on fact? What if they're doing crazy rituals in the back 40, summoning old Nordic demons and merging them with German soldiers?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what Weird Wars 2 is kind of about. Or you could even kind of, you could play like an early Hellboy scenario.
Yeah, what happens when they summon a demon and he's an eight-year-old kid, and now you have an escort mission? Like, you got to sneak this guy back here. Or one of my favorite things about the World War II era, well, as far as silly science is concerned, they actually had a working UFO. You know, it was a jet engine base, but it looked like a bloody UFO.
Well, I mean, there were so many crazy projects that, you know, Nazi Germany was working on at the time that you hear about them and you're just like, they thought that might have worked. Well, what would happen if it did?
Or little things like, you know, the old, they had a lot of beliefs based on Blavatsky's concepts, you know, of mythology, which are ended up kind of using an Aaron concept. What if there is a whole Earth? What if there's Shangri-La? What if Antarctica is actually a place where there's a base that's hidden from all the world to see? And we're not sure which side.
Oh, come, come, come. You know, at Antarctica, the UN has forces that prevents people from seeing that the world is flat.
I think so. Well, the truth is, it's just a portal.
No, you've never heard of that one? That's one of the conspiracy theories that, you know, Antarctica is well-armed. You know, the world's military forces protect Antarctica to prevent people from knowing that the world is flat.
Oh, that just, yeah, that's something. There's a word for it, but I won't say it here.
You know, not that I don't know. I'm going to diverge here just for a second because not that I want to dismiss anyone's belief in a flat Earth, except for the fact that the early Greeks knew that the world was round.
Yeah, well, they use a mathematical formula and...
Exactly. You know, it's not... You know, when the mythology of America is like, oh, Columbus proved that the world was round. Everyone knew the fucking world was round, you morons.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I'm sorry, I just... That's one of those weird lies that I was told in elementary school, and you find out later it was a lie. You're like, really? That's nuts. So.
Exactly. Well, going back to the weird stuff, like one of my favorite concepts was an idea that came up that was commonly associated with World War II. It's the concept of Vril. It's basically a kind of omnipotent cosmic energy similar to electricity, telepathy, and nuclear force put together. You control it with staffs or rods, which can shatter the strongest fortress or so. And that gives you a crazy power source to build all sorts of crazy equipment with. You know, as if guns and bombing wasn't big enough as it is when it came to that sort of thing.
Well, I think for a game,
mm-hmm.
especially a military game, I think going in slightly into what I'm going to classify as somewhat the absurd is okay because, and I think this you have a list here, realistic versus cinematic.
Yes.
And definitely, I think for most RPGs, we would prefer the more cinematic than the realistic.
Dude, I don't want my character to die of dysentery. And trust me, a lot more people died from disease than actually a lot of weapons, except for the world wars in most military conflicts.
Yeah.
Like, you might survive the bullet wound, but when you get sepsis afterwards and they don't take care of you properly, I think I'd rather take my shot getting shot.
Well, I mean, that was definitely the problem with, like, the Civil War. It's like, there's a reason that a lot of guys lost their legs. A, there wasn't enough trained actual surgeons. I mean, the guys cutting off the legs are like, well, it's just going to get gangrene. We're just going to cut it off.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and even half those guys didn't survive.
Yeah. Well, that's because we didn't find out until, like, what was it, 1880, that washing your hands will save your life.
And the guy that actually was professing that, everyone considered him a quack.
Yeah. And that's absolutely terrifying that it took almost an entire generation from conception to other thing here. Like, one of the greatest heroes that you're not going to believe his name, Jon Snow, saved probably more people than a lot of people killed. Just because he went over the urban works, urban management. Oh. And, you know, like, the real Jon Snow is a hell of a lot bigger hero than the fictional one. That's all I'm saying.
Is that the one that plotted the cholera outbreak?
Yeah, basically he's the one that dealt with the cholera outbreak and basically did his homework. And
okay, I couldn't remember his name. There's actually a great book that's very interesting to read. It's called The Ghost Map.
Oh!
It talks about the London epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's written by a guy named Stephen Johnson.
Okay.
And it's fascinating, especially if you have any interest in it, because this was like probably... in my mind, one of the earliest uses of the, you know, geographic information science, even though it wasn't a thing yet. Because he actually plotted the outbreak on a map.
Yeah.
And that's how he traced it to the water supply.
It's brilliant and kind of terrifying. But without that, he was the one that basically invented urban planning.
Yeah.
And before Jon Snow, cities were death traps, pure and simple. But around that period, around the thing, you started having populations grow fast. And
I'm sorry, I was just making sure it was actually about Jon Snow. So there you go. Yeah. There's a good book to read. It's I think less than $15 US in paperback. You can get it on the Kindle from Amazon for about $12.
Oh, absolutely.
So.
And again, like another thing you got to throw up is like, are area effect weapons going to be a thing? Like, are you going to be stuck in the middle of Britain during the Battle of Britain? Are you going to be stuck? Oh, there's a place I would never want to be, and of course that is Soviet Union during the winter. Because it theoretically is an amazing gameable environment, but I already live in a harsh landscape. I can only imagine what happens when people start shooting at you on top of that.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, any landscape is horrible. I mean, you think of World War One where you had no man's land, which was just, was pretty much just dead. There was nothing there.
Yeah.
It was bombed the shit out of or shot the shit out of.
Well, again, there's a reason they stuck trench and they basically didn't move for like quite a few years, because when they finally started moving at the end of the war, they remembered why they made the trenches in the first place.
Right.
Like, a lot of people died in the last 3 to 4 months when they finally got out of the trenches again.
Actually, what's fascinating is at the end of the Civil War,
mm-hmm.
there were hints about what World War One was, how World War One was going to be fought.
Yeah.
I forget the name of the town, but there was a city. But basically, it was trench warfare. It was at the end of World War One. It was at the end of the Civil War. And everything that we saw during World War One kind of happened during that last engagement towards the end of the Civil War. It was a siege on a town, and basically there were trenches on both sides, I believe. It was just, it was insane.
I think it was called, I'm just doing a little bit of research here, the Peterburg Project? Peterburg?
It might be.
Yeah. Let's double check. Peterburg, Virginia. Think it was, but don't quote me on that one. I might be horribly wrong.
Yeah, the Siege of Petersburg.
Yeah. And again, then you have, like, Gatling guns for the first time. You have artillery pieces. You have ironclads.
Yeah.
And you have probably one of the last wars where cavalry really could make a difference. Because even though it didn't make, you know, then you have the legendary thing where if the guy would have been decided to make a loop-de-loop around the military lines, he might have actually been a lot more effective.
Well, cavalry, as we know, as the in terms of horse cavalry.
Yes, precisely. Well, I'm not talking about, like, tanks or, you know, things here. And you also see a change in personality. Like, one of the reasons why World War One was so bloody is everybody figured out how to basically get everybody where they're supposed to be faster than they expected. You know, that's when you had the train deployments. You know, put everybody out, and you basically get them 75% of the way there already.
Yeah, it is a fascinating thing that we, you know, not to mention, I think that was the, you know, you World War One, and definitely once you get into World War Two, you know, it was the early, definitely World War One was the early motorized vehicles started happening. You know, not that they were APCs or anything like that, but you know, you were able to move troops by truck. Or other vehicle. I mean, early tanks started appearing, obviously, on World War One. And while they did not have a decisive impact on the war, they did definitely have a psychological impact on the war.
Oh, absolutely. Like, one of the things I heard a long time ago about World War II is that war wasn't won because of the Shermans. It was won because of the 2.5-ton cargo truck.
Oh, I believe it.
Because you were able material anywhere.
You know, I mean, there's that classic, what the hell do they call it? Did they call it the Red Ball Express?
I honestly don't remember.
I want to say yes. I think that was the... I'm a strange history person.
Oh, yeah. The Red Ball Extreme was a famed convoy system that applied to all these trucks moving quickly through Europe after breaking out from the D-Bay beaches.
Yep.
The beaches. So, yes, you're absolutely right.
Hey, see? One for watching documentaries.
Yeah. And again, if you go for more water warfare... Like, you know how we talked a while back about how one of the best eras for spies is the Cold War?
Yeah.
because you have enough technology to get in trouble, but you also, it's one of the reasons why we never had a major war is because we had the bomb. And we couldn't escalate like you could before then without causing a lot of problems.
Yeah.
You know, and part of the thing was basically having to, you know, when Joe Stalin saying, no, it's not a war, when they were doing the Korea thing, you know everybody's backing down. Because MacArthur, you dick. And you know what I'm talking about if you know your history.
Yeah.
Okay, but yeah, that's just part of the fun when it comes to sort of military campaigns. Like, one of the things I would recommend if you decide to use, like, a military campaign is actually something that I picked up from Heroes of Battle 3rd Edition here, where when you design the battlefield, you actually don't do it like a map or a grid, and you don't do it like a set piece. You do it like a flowchart.
Where yeah, I can see that.
If this happens, then you go from here, and if this happens, then you go here. Here's what might happen in this location, and so forth. Because that way, it allows you to respond while still setting it up here. Like, here's where you can rest. Here's where you won't be able to rest, even if you think you will. And here's where there's a good chance that you might run into this line of troops. Or this is where you might run into that secret weapon that you just somehow blunder into. And this is when you probably should run away because a small army's coming towards you. Or, you know, another good example might be the desert fighting that happened in Northern Africa, which is a totally different environment in the World War II era and has its own things here, where you have to deal with you probably build a small convoy of the guys in the LRRCs who basically acted as the communication/supply network between, you know, for the Allies when they were fighting Rommel. Hmm. And you could end up in the desert, you could end up with all those weird mythological legends, you know, of Northern Africa, Egypt, etc. And throw in a bit of weirdness in that thing for its own good measure. Like, what happens if you're in the middle of, you know, you're a small tank patrol and you come across a pyramid that wasn't there yesterday because it just sort of came out of the sand? You know, do you call it back for your CO or do you go in there and take a look?
All of a sudden, the only thing I can think of is a little bit of the Brandon Fraser, The Mummy movie.
I love that movie. I don't know why, I just do.
It's a good guilty pleasure movie.
Yes.
It was probably the last movie that he was probably decent in.
Well, again, he was playing a hardcore guy who was basically part of the French Foreign Legion, an American who was thrown in there. He was going to be hung at the first beginning of the movie. So he's, you know, a really tough guy. And then you basically, well, they essentially, for The Mummy, they split up Indiana Jones into multiple characters.
Yeah.
You know, because all three characters represent a different aspect of, well, one of the greatest archaeologists of all time, even if he's fictional.
I wouldn't again, having studied archaeology, I don't think I would classify Indiana Jones as an archaeologist.
No, he's a treasure hunter, pure and simple, yeah. Because, you know, as fun as it is, I don't think anybody would watch 2.5 hours of a guy digging in a 10x10 area.
No, exactly not. But you know. Trust me, I know enough archaeologists that they all groan when people are like, oh, you're like Indiana Jones. No.
Well, the thing is, regardless of archaeological finds, you don't want to move the thing. Like, where you find it is almost as important as what you find.
Yeah.
It's in many ways more important because you can find out inferences and data from that.
Yeah, trust me. I don't know if I've ever told people this, but I've actually done archaeological digs.
Right on.
You know, I'm sure I've mentioned it on the show before.
Oh, I think you have, but that's okay.
Yeah, I've... As I always tell people, yeah, I've dug up dead bodies.
And again, then you can also, whether you want to mix in other genres like fantasy, martial arts, space, superhero, or even time travel, depending where you're going there. Like, one of the most, like, again, I grew up where there was a series you may have heard of called Command and Conquer, where spinoff series was Red Alert, where basically, they worked on the assumption that by killing Hitler off early, it allowed the Soviets to basically take prominence in that area. And then you got all the weird technology and so forth as you deal with military-grade units. And again, you can do as much with the Russians as you can with the Nazis if you want to use them as the villain or the backdrop. Or you could end up fighting, like, guerrilla warfare and so forth. Or you end up in the middle of nowhere, like... One of my favorite most recent movies that's kind of tangentially connected to Vietnam was, of all things, King Kong Skull Island, which was a military effort on Skull Island. it began pretty much like your typical 60s movie until the gorilla showed up. It was a fun movie. Like, I put it on par with, like, The Mummy. Hmm. But for different reasons, if that makes any sense.
No, it does.
You know. And
I think the only other thing I really want to talk to about military games is I'm going to say character creation. Because one of the problems with the military game typically is everyone, in terms of a unit, typically has almost the same identical skill set.
Yeah, but that was intentional.
Well, I understand, but I'm just saying it does. That's why I was saying, like, in the fantasy game, where you can kind of get away with the fact that you have these characters that are outside the normal chain, and you can still get away with that in a more, like, a World War II setting. But
no.
What do you do with those characters that, for all practical purposes, are, for lack of a better term, the same character class with pretty much the same skill set?
Yeah, that's when the devil's in the details when it comes to that stuff there. Like, you almost want to play retirees, kind of like how your travel campaign.
Well,
how everybody's ex-military or some degree, or U.S. or Merchant Marine.
Yeah, but I think if you're running at, like, an actual, like, okay, World War II, World War I, whatever, there is a lot of play people mm-hmm. don't realize. And I think what you have to allow yourself to do is one of two things. Either A, I think everyone should have a skill.
Yeah.
That nobody else has.
Absolutely.
And or they have it at a higher level than anybody else. And it shouldn't be a combat skill on the mm-hmm. surface. Or if it is, it's something that's not used that often. Or if it is used often, it's something that most people don't take. Like in the World War I or World War II campaign, maybe someone has, like, I don't know, knife fighting really high.
Yeah.
You know. The other thing to do is to obviously emphasize people's hobbies or interests.
Yeah.
You know, a skill that emphasizes a hobby or interest. And this is, I think this can be, this is a kind of nice in the, like in the Call of Cthulhu campaigns, this isn't that hard because people want to, like, I want to know a little bit about the occult, or I want to know, mm-hmm. you know, maybe you need, you know, maybe someone needs to know Latin or German or something.
You know, or, maybe, you know, throw a little bit of weirdness. What if you have some guy who suddenly can hear radio signals without a radio? Why is that? We're going to find out.
It's the fillings in his teeth.
Exactly. And again, stupid stuff like that might act as a really good fun fuck with them there. And one of the things I loved about the old military, you know, myths of World War II is in many ways they were pet-obsessed. You know, they often had a pet of some sort or wanted a pet of some sort, you know? You found a dog in the middle of nowhere, no group of Yank soldiers aren't going to, you know, they're going to take it in
yeah.
if they can.
I think World War I was kind of like that a little bit too, at least yeah. when you get to, like, the air units.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I think they all had mascots.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. And again, like, anywhere you go, take a myth from where you are and twist it. Like, again, what if you end up in Indonesia during World War II fighting against the Japanese and suddenly one of those weird vampires with all the entrails hanging out of their heads comes and attacks you, you're not going to know what's happening. Or if you decide to do, like, more of a space campaign, I got one word for you: aliens. Which is basically the ultimate example of reskinning a military campaign, but putting it in space, where basically you're not outclassed, but you're outnumbered.
Hmm.
You know, because xenomorphs in a straight fight, they're not going to win, but because they're sneaky as heck and they're in an enclosed area, and you can't use your biggest guns, then it becomes a threat. And that's when you want to nuke it from orbit.
You know, another TV series that comes to mind is Space Above and Beyond.
Oh, heck yeah. That, you know, of course they had to make them basically do everything, but I have no problem with that. Like, for one season, it was incredible. If you're trying to do a military campaign, which
yeah.
actually, you know, he actually had our buddy in there, the guy who just died.
He was in the first episode, and I was really angry that he wasn't in other episodes.
Yeah, like, he was still the show. He kind of did in the first episode anyway.
Yeah.
You know, like, again, the one episode that always impressed me about that series was the Angry Angel. The last of a battalion who has to fight a super ship with a secret weapon. And it basically turns into a World War II dogfight.
So, And of course, you know, if you want to move it to more outward, there's always the reboot of Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
As a military campaign of mm-hmm. sorts.
Absolutely. What happens when you've lost your planet and you're on the run? Yeah. And you're running out of resources, man. Like, it's just a matter of time, which explains some of the attitude and personalities, as everybody's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder on that ship for different degrees. And that's when you want a more realistic campaign, because, you know, you're all flawed and you might not come out of it.
Trying to think if there's anything we've missed in this so far.
Well, if we did, I guess, audience, let us know.
Yeah, and I have no problem ever retouching this subject, because it is a broad subject.
Yep. But again, big things, supplies, equipment, and targets.
It's weird, though, because I think the military-style campaign is something that I think happens in certain games more often than we think. And, I think that's the other thing I wanted to touch on, is I think the other reason that I think most people like the commando-style games is that typically in a commando environment, even though one of the players might be unofficially in charge,
yeah,
everyone still gets a voice because of the nature of a commando operation.
Yeah. And right? On top of that, yeah, go on.
And I think that's important. I think that's important to realize that, you know, if you are, hey, I'm the captain and everyone else is a private, well, that doesn't that's great, but everyone still has to have a voice in a military campaign. Otherwise, not everyone's going to enjoy it. That's not to say that, hey, you know, I think, you know, I'm going to give the commands, or, you know, what, you know, I don't know. There's definitely a give and take. You have to kind of step outside a little bit of the realm of realism
mm-hmm.
for that. But I think if you've ever, I mean, let's take Platoon as a classic example. You have some yes. guy that's in charge, but there's a staff sergeant or somebody that's really in charge.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, again, like, if you're going to have a fearless leader, I'd rather see it giving a mechanical benefit of some sort than actually just barking out orders.
Right.
Like, if you listen to me, you got a +2 bonus. Suddenly there's a reason to listen to him, especially if he knows what the heck he's doing, or he might be asking for advice. Like, or you could have an EOD specialist, you could have a stealth operative, you could have all sorts of weird stuff when it comes to that stuff there.
Yeah. Well, I know that there is a, I forget what it's called in Savage Worlds, but I don't know if it's in the base rule book or one of the other rule books, but there is one where the person gets an edge where they're allowed to spend bennies on their other people.
Yeah.
I forget exactly which one of that is, but I always thought, well, that's cool, you know? You know, like, yeah, you're like, oh, crap, I get to spend bennies on other people. That sucks, but, you know, it's kind of cool in the aspect that gives them a tangible benefit for having that, I don't know, like being in charge, if you will.
Well, if you're in charge, you want your party to survive, because if they survive, they're going to save your bacon.
Right.
You know, it's as simple as that, and there's many different archetypes you can use when it comes down to it there. And then, I should be kicking myself. We almost missed one of the most important, for lack of a better term, military games of all time, or movies. Starship Troopers. Eh. Or Man vs. Bug.
Yeah, you know, even though it had almost zero to do with the book.
Oh, no. I'm not even going to get started there, because, well, I'm a fan of Roughnecks, which was the CGI cartoon that came after that.
That's the funny thing, is that the cartoon was more interesting than the obviously the movie was.
Mm-hmm.
So
exactly, and again, like when you're fighting military, you know, I'll be blunt: the first alien encounter we might have might be a war. Simple as that. We better be ready if it's something like that. Otherwise, it might be the equivalent of, well, our own colonial experiences. But that's either here nor there. Anything else?
No, I think that's it.
Okay. I'll go for it, then.
All right, why don't we move on to the Kickstarters?
Sure.
All right, so there are three Kickstarters up front that are... Hold on, what the hell just happened? I lost one. I closed one out. Don't you love that?
No worries.
So there are three Kickstarters that I want to mention because they're all conventions of sorts.
Okay.
So first up, we have the TravelerCon USA, October 5th and through the 7th of this year.
Okay.
They've reached their goal. So if you're interested, it's going to be in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So if you're in that area or can make that, you might want to check out that. They are doing another challenge coin this year, which is going to be the Soleimani, challenge coins for the Soleimani.
Right on.
Last year it was, I think, the Aces and Eights lift unit, which the 11th 88th lift unit, which I thought was cool because that actually has a reference to one of the adventures in one of the old Traveler's Aid Society books, Journal of the Traveler's Aid Society. So I think that's
awesome.
Cool. That's kind of a weird thing that they're doing, and I like that because you can actually just back the Kickstarter just for the challenge coin. At least they did last year. I don't know if they're – yeah, $18. It's probably a little much for to back it for the convention, but like I said, if you're into travel, you're like, that's just too cool. I got to have at least the coin.
I'm going to lie to you. This is one of the places on the con that I've been here in the past, and I loved it. So it would be all, like, you know, more places than others. Like, I wouldn't mind going back there if I could actually afford it right now.
Yeah. So there's that convention going on. There is the CharCon Game Convention in Charleston, Wyoming.
Yeah.
July 13th through the 15th. They've actually also reached their goal, which is cool.
Yeah. Well, we want people to go to cons because then they meet new people, they game, they get new experiences. And generally speaking, you get to play outside your envelope and get to try new things.
And then the other one is the Queen City Conquest 2018 in Buffalo, New York. The dates for that are September 7th through the 9th.
Right on.
So that's cool. And I definitely think funding the smaller conventions or Kickstarters has become a thing. Because like right in my area, we have Maricopa Con, which I don't care for the way they do their Kickstarters. But that's the way they've been funding their convention, I think, for the last 3 to 4 years, if memory serves me. It might be longer.
Yeah.
So if any of those conventions interest you, they're going to be out there. And you can obviously kickstart to get there. And I'm sure the only one I never figured out was Maricopa Con, if you can actually just show up at the door and go. That was always the weird thing about Maricopa Con for me. And if anyone from Maricopa Con is listening to this episode, I'd like to know. I've never emailed them and asked them. It's just one of those things where the dates were just never convenient for me, but I was always just kind of curious.
Well, again, you can justify a con that's like a hop, skip, and a jump away a lot easier than going down to, say, another country.
Well, you know, like even within the U.S., I can't justify going to Indianapolis right now.
Yeah.
So
I don't blame you.
I'm not
there,
going to Gen Con.
Yeah. Well, again, been there quite a few years.
I think I've gone to Gen Con enough.
Yeah.
And some people were like, how can you go to Gen Con enough? Well, you can, trust me. I think I've told people many times that I think that convention has gotten so large, it's just not fun to go to.
Yeah, I can see that.
So, I mean, I think my funnest time was roaming around the miniature hall. I didn't really, I mean, other than that, not as much fun. I mean, that was the funnest part of the last time I went to Gen Con.
Yikes.
Okay. So let's talk RPGs. Kickstarters.
Yes,
we have the Black Void RPG, a dark fantasy tabletop RPG about the fall and resurgence of humanity. And they're a good chunk through their goal, and they still got 25 days.
I know. It's pretty amazing. Well, they're about two-thirds of the way there. There's a good chance they'll make it or not.
Yeah. And I'm not sure where it's originally from. DKK is the monetary amount listed. And where the hell does it say? Oh, Denmark. Okay. So it's from Denmark. So that makes some sense.
I do like the art.
No, it looks good.
And, it's basically a dark situation here. The fall of Babel. It's basically a harsh, gritty environment.
Yeah.
And some of their monsters are just, well, let's just say they're Lovecraftian influenced.
You know, I definitely, as a person from the U.S., I love seeing stuff from other countries because every country has a different viewpoint on how certain things are.
Absolutely. You know,
different cultures. So I always like seeing stuff from other places.
Agreed wholeheartedly. Like, it's just fun just seeing how they take a basic concept, they make their own version of the boogeyman.
You know, and I mean, if you're in the U.S., I mean, the basic rule book in PDF format's only about $12. Mm-hmm. So that's not too bad.
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah, they're about two-thirds of the way there. We wish them luck, of course. And what system do they use?
I think it's...
12-sided dice. Difficulty rating. So basically it's a...
I'm guessing it's something that they... I mean, it's not like D&D. It must be fairly custom.
Yep.
So.
Okay.
All right. So next up, we have the Shattered Tower RPG. It's listed as a mythpunk RPG set in a hostile world built on ashes of an outer and forgotten one, focused on survival and exploration. And it's already funded. They were only asking for a little over $6,000 US. It's from Italy.
Yep.
You know, so.
Be fun to see what they... Well, if they already got funded, that's half the battle right there. And so they basically have 6 playable races, 60 different dangers. They have a unique exploration system, which I like unique. And it looks like there's a bit of... I don't know. It's almost like a your environment where you got the fantasy stuff and then you got a few, you know, cool toys on top of that, everything else.
Yeah. It uses some sort of D6 system because they have make a mention that with our particular D6 system,
mm-hmm.
you know, I guess that's to differentiate it from the D6 system that was kind of like the old Star Wars system.
Yeah, that'd be fun, and I'd be interested in seeing how this one actually kind of intrigues me. It'll be added to the 24-hour rule here, because I don't know if I'll pick it up or not, but it definitely looks terribly amusing. So, we'll see if it lasts.
Okay, so next up we have Nagul. It's just listed as a Mesoamerican giant robot RPG.
Okay, that's original. Full points for that.
Yeah. Aspect-inspired giant robots. So, that's
So they're basically playing Zords, but in with a Mesoamerican background. That's kind of cool, actually.
They're shy of halfway through their goal right now.
Okay, well.
But they still got 23 days to go. It's possible.
Yeah, it certainly is.
I mean, I give them points for originality. It's tough. I guess their artist is Portuguese. I don't know. It's tough. You know, these are one of those ones where... Luckily, this is, I mean, obviously it's not too serious, but sometimes with source material, it's tough to be respectful.
Yeah, this is, I think we had a culture episode a few episodes back where you said you got to be careful when you deal with other people's cultures.
Yeah, I mean, luckily this one is at the point where I don't think it's a big deal.
Yeah.
But I think if you were obviously going to just play... In a Mesoamerican fantasy setting, that could be tough, unless obviously you had someone who knew a lot about the Mesoamerican area.
Yeah, this is essentially a reskin Power Rangers, and I think that's actually kind of an awesome thing.
Yeah. All right, so now we have a Journey Away, a non-challenged based fantasy RPG.
Okay, I'm curious. Let's see what it is. Okay, sell me on it. Sorry, I'm just reading the text here.
It says most tabletop RPGs are challenge-based, meaning the gameplay mechanics center around determining the success or failure of your actions. You face a challenge, you decide how to overcome it, and the dice tell you whether you succeed or not. Journey Away is not challenge-based. Instead, the mechanics center around prompting new developments and complications to interact with the game world. You engage in a situation, not necessarily even a challenge. Describe how you would approach the situation, and the dice tell you how many or what sorts of development arise, then mm-hmm. it's up to you, up to your fellow players to decide exactly what those developments mean. So mm-hmm. it's a modified storytelling system?
Sounds like it.
I mean, that's what I mean. I mean, not to take it away from whatever they're doing, but that's what it sounds like. It's very much more story and oriented, and nothing against those. I mean, I know some people that's the kind of RPG they like, you know.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I mean, I come from an era, unfortunately, that everything is, you know, hit it with a hammer.
Yeah.
You know?
This is one I would have to see in play before I decide one way or the other. It sounds intriguing, but you kind of want to see how it plays out in the, you know, like, this would be one that I'd really like to see a YouTube video on it or something. Yeah. Maybe it's part of the click link.
Yeah.
Just to see how it flows, what the, you know, how it works.
Right. You know, and this, I mean, depending on how complicated this game is, this would be, to me, a game that you might play with children.
Absolutely.
So, because it's like, you know, not necessarily, you know, that's more, that might be more appropriate for a child.
Yeah.
I mean, even an adult, but I'm just saying, you know, children might grasp it better that way.
Yeah,
okay.
That's...
So let's see what else we got. We have Yandaros, the Darkstar award-winning Simbarium campaign. I'm not even familiar. Do you remember? Do you know Simbarium?
I'm sorry, man. I totally dropping a blank on this one.
Yeah. So if you play this game, obviously this is a setting for you. And it's out of Sweden, so that might be why I'm not familiar with it. I'm sure it probably has come up in a Kickstarter before, is the only thing I can think of.
Okay, but I'm just trying to see if it'll give me a quick 30-second elevator speech, like in text. Okay, so it's basically translated from Swedish to English. Okay, this is one of those times where I really wish, I'm sure the video tells you, but I'd love a little paragraph that says, this is the world. Instead of, this is a best-selling world, that's great. I'm just trying to see if it says it, what it is. Because Yandaros the Starkosaur is the third episode in the Chronicle of Throne of Thorns. So it looks like it's part of an adventure path of some sort.
Yeah, apparently the rules are available in English, French, German, Italian, Portuguese, and Spanish.
And Swedish,
obviously.
I give him full kudos for translations. Something I'd love to be able to do, I just don't have it in me.
Yeah. Again, this is one that I think unless you've already played the game, it might be a hard sell.
Yeah, I'd have to see the video.
But clearly, whoever their core audience, they've reached, because with 15 days to go, they have five times their amount of the Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, that obviously they have found their market, which is good.
No, that's
good.
Oh,
it was Ennies and Nominated Player's Guide back in... They actually have it as part of the Kickstarter thing, so... I don't remember them for the Ennies. They might have been before my time.
Oh, it's so hard to say. I see so many... Honestly, I've done Guess the Ennies so many times. Mm-hmm. 10 times, to be exact. Did I do it 10 times? I don't know if I did it every year. Maybe 9 times. I'd have to go back to season one, and I don't want to do that. That's been too long ago for me.
Fair enough.
So.
Besides, it's time for some new experience and stuff here.
Yeah. All right.
No, this is curious, but I need more information. I'll take a look, maybe. Okay.
So, next up, we have Damn Magazine, a DCC RPG magazine and news for the Spring 2018 issue. I never even knew there was a magazine before that.
Well, apparently they're trying to fund their Dragon Call Classic role-playing game magazine here. Who's it done by? Paul Wolf. I don't recognize the name, but I'm sure he's very important to some shape or form. Yeah.
He's out of Austin, apparently.
Okay.
You know, and I say, hey, you know what? If you play Dungeon Crawl Classics, maybe you might want to look it up.
Absolutely.
I mean, they reached their goal, so it's not like they're not funded. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. And again, I'm a sucker for this incredibly silly art. You know what I'm talking about, that late 80s feel of the art, black and white. And even though there's, you know, it's not the best in the world, but it just makes me grin from ear to ear.
All right, so next up we have Art of War, a Bushido I can never pronounce the other one. Wakzana? Is that how you pronounce that?
Sure. We'll go with that.
Setting for Savage Worlds and 5th Edition.
Okay.
So, and, basically another just fantasy martial art campaign that's available. There two different versions. Obviously, a Savage World Edition and a D&D 5th Edition version.
Okay.
$15 for the PDF, either way, U.S., they got 21 days to go. They're a little under half their goal. They're asking for 3,500. They're at about 1,200.
Well, I'd almost do one or the other at this point. Like, I just, you know, this thing here. Although I do give them full credit for the FAQ right there on the page. And they have the differences. Why Savage World and 5th Edition? Why we're kickstarting Art of War? What's the difference between each version? Inside the different versions, what they want to do, how they want to do it.
Yeah.
This one actually feels a little easier to digest than some of the other books we've done recently, you know.
Yeah.
Because they basically say that out there.
They obviously describe what's going to be in the Savage World Edition and then what's going to be in the 5th Edition. And obviously, if I was going to play this, I'd probably just do the Savage World Edition.
Completely understandable there.
Yeah. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with 5th Edition. It's just, I don't know, I've come to where I will play, obviously, Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition, and I would definitely do 5th Edition over 3.5 or even 4th Edition D&D.
Yeah.
But I just don't really, D&D is not my go-to game anymore.
No, I think it's safe to assume Savage Worlds is your jam.
For the most part, and mostly this, I think that there's a lot of... I mean, it obviously has its own shortcomings, just like any game does.
Yeah.
But the shortcomings I can deal with.
Well, if you have enough players, play what you want.
Right. Exactly. And let's face it, any setting that can do everything from a World War II crazy, Weird Wars to Flash Gordon to a far... off-space game. That's my vote.
Throw it in the stew and see what comes out.
Exactly. Okay, so next up we have Wingless, an angelic role-playing game. It's powered by the Apocalypse system of around the lives of conscripted guardian angels and their wards.
Okay, well, I'll give them points for originality.
I like this. About, death is a way station with only two trails to follow. One leads to Eden, the paradise of promise. The other leads to delusion, where lost souls wander. Most who come to this after travel to Eden. Few wander the after in their delusions, and the rare are those who choose neither. Those that do not move on to are filled with conflict, regret, remorse, yearning, desire. Whatever the reason, they refuse to move on with the cycle of life. And the author cannot have that. Any soul who chooses to neither wander or ascend to Eden are conscripted into the author's security force against the dangers of the after. They become keepers, guardians of other living souls, protecting them from wanderers, fail, and unnameable horrors until their souls are prepared to make a choice. They become wingless. Okay.
This goes with the military campaign concept, because basically you're drafted into an afterlife military.
Yeah, I would say so. Wow. Interesting concept. I will give them points for that. I have never actually played the Apocalypse system, although I do own Tremulous.
Okay.
I just, honestly, I've never found a group to play it with.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'm the game master to run it.
Yeah, I can see that. It's okay. Yeah, I've had a similar experience. I played in two different games of the Apocalypse Engine. One was Spirit of 77, and the other was a attempt to try to do a thing here. And ultimately, the thing our GM had the biggest problem with was the fact that in most adventures, you plot everything out. In Apocalypse World, you kind of throw everybody in the fan and you see what comes out.
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely Tremulous is like that, because the way it works is the players make certain choices which actually generate the world that they're playing in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a little tough for a lot of game masters. So, okay, so next up we have the Call of Cthulhu Leather Campaign Journals, which, by the way, have already reached their goal. They were asking for nearly $7,000 US, and they actually got almost $1,600 US. And these guys are out of Melbourne, Australia.
Oh, right on. That's
now,
amazing.
Here's the thing. Now, last episode we talked about there were the D&D player journals.
I remember those.
And so the only thing that people ask, well, why these over those? Why are people backing this thing? And the only explanation I can give you is Call of Cthulhu has, I think, always had a history for props.
Yes, I'm agreeing completely on that one.
So because of that, definitely the user base, these are things that they would buy. There's a market for this, for this particular game, whether you like it or not, whether you think, oh, my game doesn't have that market. Well, they just don't have the history for that.
Yeah.
I mean, Call of Cthulhu, I mean, hell, even if you don't play Call of Cthulhu, if you just look at the Cthulhu mythos, there are people who are professional prop makers that make Call of Cthulhu-related props. It's insane when you actually look at, when you go out there and look, you know, do searches for this stuff. And it's just like, holy crap. These guys are professionals. They do this shit for a living, you know, that are out there making these props. And you're just like, that makes no sense.
Well, I also think there's a certain degree of artisan style that it has its own unique style.
Yeah.
And therefore is marketable, because I'm getting a serious deja vu from this project. I don't know why.
Because I think there have been other projects like this.
Yeah, must be.
I this is not the first time a journal. I mean, and the journal is simple. I mean, it's really just a cover with a whole bunch, you know, with a, looks like some sort of simple title page and a whole bunch of lines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a blind entry book where you can just put your own stuff in. And it's like, hey, you know, that's great. And, oh, they do actually have their own challenge coin, by the way. Challenge coins are becoming very popular in these circles. And again, yeah. I think it's the weird collectability of them.
Well, it's collectability. It's not the heaviest thing in the world. It's, you can customize it and make it your own.
Yeah.
You're not fighting with the wood problem, which we talked about in the past.
Yeah. And so, you know, and I, you know, challenge coins have become very big in the U.S. military. And then, you know, I always, you know, I laugh because I always tell people, it's like, well, I got a real challenge coin. Thank you very much.
yeah. Well,
but again, I have some traveler ones just because I think they're kooky. You know, they're kind of cool. You know, from a, if you are into a certain game that has a certain history, they become almost like, I don't want to say real because that's not a good term, but they are almost semi-real. You know, they definitely operate in this area of the brain, like if that unit actually existed, you know, sort of thing.
Well, you get into the uncanny valley, kind of like you're close enough that it's not real, but it's getting there, you know?
The only problem with this campaign is if you want the printed material, estimated shipping costs are high for these books.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're saying $30 Australian to ship to the U.S. I'm not quite sure how that translates to the U.S. right now.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. Like, they're saying it's shipping friendly. And
that's about $24 U.S.
Yeah.
Because it looks like about $10 Australian is about $8 US.
Okay, that's not the worst I've heard. But
right,
still.
But I'm just saying, you add that to your printed version.
Yeah.
I think that could get high.
Yeah.
So, still kind of cool, if that's your thing.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing there.
So, okay, so we've got just a few more. Let's get through these. Let's power through these. We have the Savage Bestiary Reforged. It's for Savage Kingdoms. So it's an extended bestiary for Savage Kingdoms. They've almost reached their goal, so that's kind of cool.
Okay,
I've never played Savage Kingdoms. Have you?
Sorry, man. I haven't had the pleasure.
Yeah. I mean, obviously it exists. It's just these are, again, there's... That's the interesting thing about RPGs. There's always these small games you're just like, I've never heard of them. You know, it's like, okay.
Dude, you give me a library and I'll read myself to death. And this is another example of what will cause me to read, because Monster Manuals.
Yeah.
I always love monster manuals in all their incantations, because you'd always find something that's really cool that you can steal from. And even if I never played Savage Beastry before, it'd be kind of cool seeing what they came up with as far as their creative processes are concerned.
Oh, and this one I won't talk about, because apparently they had a really... it already ended.
Okay.
Okay, so we have the Dungeons and Dragons 5th Edition module, the Dwarven Smith's Tome. I don't know, they reached their goal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's... Right.
I'm glad to hear that.
Again, so it's another 5th Edition. I would say if you're interested in 5th Edition book, you know, modules, check it out, see if it works for you.
Well, again, it's 5th Edition modules, a couple of short guys that you can basically fiddle your way through. And it looks like it's talking about their earlier campaigns. I'm just trying to see... Okay, I just want to ask, like, the key question you always ask about this. Okay, there is a catch-up special, a PDF catch-up special. It'll cost $30, so obviously you're going in the middle of the adventure, but if you want the entire kit and caboodle, I'm just trying to see... Okay, here's another one of my beefs. Maybe it's played in the video here. I always want an overview of, okay, this is a part of an adventure. Okay, give me your elevator speech, why I should invest. Why over another module? Like, instead, it seems like they're jumping right into the thing here. But maybe, you know, again, I'm always going to be a little biased because I haven't hit the video button, you know, when I get these things.
Nope, I understand completely.
You know, but I think not only should you have the video showing off all the really awesome stuff, but the first paragraph should always be, this is the product. This is why it's awesome. Sell, sell, sell. Instead of, welcome to Rhyme's Fest 5th Edition, Kickstarter Press in support of the Place of the Way. That tells me nothing. You know, that just tells me that it's a product. Okay, what about it?
Yeah.
What's it about? Or maybe it's in the FAQs. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, so let's press on. We have Battlecruiser Alamo RPG powered by Era D10.
Okay. I ain't gonna lie to you, the art almost sells me on it just on its sheer, you know, style here to begin with. Yeah, it's been a sucker for this face off. No problem.
Yeah, the Era D10? That system sounds familiar, but I'm not sure. Does that sound familiar to you?
I'm sorry, I hate to say it, but no.
Huh.
Okay, it's a D10 rule set that's a lightweight and dynamic system designed to help the players experience everything from suspense, film moment, blah, blah, blah. I'm just reading. Okay, they actually have videos underneath to show you how to use it. So that's full kudos on that one.
So they've already reached their goal. So if you want to back it, it's going to happen.
Yeah, pretty much. And
so that's cool.
Again, I've always been a sucker for a good space opera. So.
And I'm not familiar with Richard Tung. Obviously, this is a work of his.
That I am completely unfamiliar with.
So I'm assuming it's a series of books.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's basically...
Yeah, it's the Tri-Planetary Confederation novels.
Yeah, because escaping a shattered Earth, millions of desperate refugees fled to the depths of the solar system, to Mars, close to distant Tryon. To build new homes. And then the colonies succeed.
So this is interesting. Obviously, if you read those books, I guess the author of the books was involved in this.
That's always a plus.
So that's kind of nice.
Well, again,
I don't think I could do that. If I was a writer of something, I don't think I could try to translate it to a game. I think that would lose something.
Well, there is certain degrees of elements you could probably steal or not steal to make it gameable. Like, a book I recommend for anybody who's trying to translate a medium is a book called Hamlet's Hit Points. It was written by Robin D. Laws.
I don't think I've read that one.
Oh, it was written by Robin D. Laws, you know, the particular Ken and Rob talk about stuff. And he talks about how when you're dealing with mediums and movies and you're trying to make it gameable, you look for the upbeats and the downbeats, kind of for the narrative storytelling style. And you can actually... Basically, it's one of the best books I've ever seen to how to create from another medium.
I may have to put that on my short list.
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's get into the final three and we get the hell out of here. We have System, the RPG game, a science fiction fantasy compilation.
Sounds good.
System, with two Y's, a tabletop RPG set in a world where the laws of the system are breaking down and nothing runs like it should.
Yep. Well, it looks like a fun little project for sure, but unfortunately it doesn't look like it's being funded very well.
So they obviously have a video. The artwork that they have on the page does not impress me.
No, I think. Well, again, I
get it's okay, but it's not
better than I can draw. But still,
No. You know what? I always have that. I am no artist. But obviously, they have 47 days to go, and they are asking for $10,000 US, and they're at $391.
Yeah, this is screaming fantasy heartbreaker.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, don't get me wrong. It looks like a fun project, but might be a little ambitious for your first one. I don't know.
You know, I probably so. I wish them luck, and maybe if it fails, they retry with something smaller.
Again, the worst thing that can happen is getting your product funded and not knowing what the hell to do with it.
I think we've talked at length a number of times about either Kickstarters that were wildly successful and it nearly killed the people that did them.
Yeah, exactly. So
it's much better to be. Smaller. I also think that people should try smaller projects for their Kickstarters when they first start. That's just me.
Start with like something like a module or something and just sort of see what you can get the word out. Like that way you can set up your infrastructure like our good buddy Mike from last week, you know?
Yeah.
In Lizard Draw, the guy does amazing work. And like the guy's a workhorse.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so we have next up we have the Dragon Heresy Introductory Set Fantasy RPG, a 5th edition variant. Explore and conquer a Norse inspired land with Dragon Heresy, with modified 5th edition rules, and secure your place in the sagas, or die trying. You know, definitely the Norse mythology is a big one that people draw from. They've reached their goal. They were asking for about $3,500 US. They got $8,400 so far, and they still got 12 days at the time of this.
Okay. I actually bought some of his product before. This is the guy who I picked up the Dungeon Grappling thing. And he's... I actually listened to a couple of his podcasts where he's shilling this stuff. And he's one of these guys that basically re-coordinated the combat system to try to be a little bit more based on a bit more of a realistic style. Like, where your armor basically blunts blows, you have different ways to manipulate stuff, and you're basically burning vigor to try to do stuff. Because if you take a wound, that's when you're really hurt. You know, I don't know the full details here. Probably better, but obviously... other people heard his elevator speech and loved it. So, and he's put a lot of work and effort to this sucker. Like, this has amazing form factor.
Yeah. Well, not only that, I mean, in terms of the stuff that I've seen for the Norse, at least this is one that's probably a little bit more, because it's 5th edition based, even if the rules are varianted, they're probably a lot more accessible for most people.
Yeah, and I'll give them credit for the one silly thing they do that I don't know how, well, I'm assuming it's going to be cost effective, but at a certain Kickstarter level, you actually get a shield.
Where is that? Oh, is that the $500? Yeah.
Yeah, basically, as long as you're in the United States, they can actually get your ship, you know, shield to you. It looks like it's all gone, so obviously somebody liked it.
Oh, yeah, let me see. Is it all gone? Wow. You can still get it for $500.
Yeah, that's not happening.
Yeah, well, but I like it because it's like, hey, here, we'll send you a shield.
Yeah. Well, my only worry about physical products when it comes to role-playing stuff is you end up with, what was it, the first year of a couple of years of Kickstarter where everybody was doing like a mug or something, which takes away from the original product. But obviously he's doing something right and he's got it here, so.
Well, like I said, I will give him credit for the fact that it's insane. But work, you know, it's like, it's an insanity that's workable, you know, because it's just, you look at, I mean, he has photos of it, and it's like, okay, I get it. It's insane, but I get it.
Well, I ain't gonna lie to you. There's part of me that still wants to go to the SCA for obvious reasons, and this is the vacation.
Yeah, I have not. Let me put it this way: I have nothing against the SCA.
Yeah,
I think it's an interesting group of people.
Yeah.
That said, I mean, because definitely I've been to one of their events because my ex was interested in trying to do the SCA stuff, which she never followed through with. But I went to one of these events, and obviously their seminars were fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. That's just one of the things I can't do.
I understand completely. Like, you know, my equivalent of hanging out a medieval thing was going down to medieval times when I was in Dallas.
Well, and I also think the problem, especially today, is it's like the SCA was probably a more codified early version of cosplay.
Yeah.
Now, of course, people don't give a crap about the authenticity of the historic.
Yeah, so, I think there's been a decline because I don't know.
And don't get me wrong, I kind of get it because I've heard differing opinions on the SEA from a variety of people why they choose not to be involved, and usually there's very good reasons for it. Usually it's some sort of interpersonal, quasi-political.
I can believe that. Or so, to put it in a nutshell, high school never ends.
It does. You just have to choose not to involve yourself with people that still have high school mentalities.
Can't argue with that.
So, you know, but you're right. Definitely almost every hobby I've ever been to, there are other people that think it's still sort of high school. And they think they're the top dog. And I'm like, you don't own the hobby. So to be blunt, go fuck yourself.
Exactly. And you don't realize how much of somebody who thinks they're a big fish in a small pond until you go out and you say, hey, have you heard of this guy? Who's that? And if there even is some sort of bigwig in the thing here, like I just recently had an experience on a forum of all things where I mentioned a game designer who's won multiple Ennies and they looked at me like guppies at feeding time.
Yeah.
Which tells you how much our hobby is like mountain railroads once you get at a certain point.
Oh, and I know people hate that myth, that comparison. I don't want it to be like mountain railroads. And I'm like, you know what? We are not a large group of people. No matter what, I don't care what people look at, you know, Gen Con and look at the attendance. It's like, yeah, that's a big amount. But when you actually take that over the overall U.S. population, and obviously not all those people are from the U.S., but let's just use that as a number, it's not significant.
Well, again, the internet has given us the distinct advantage, the ability to talk to each other. And that alone gives us, I don't know, increases the ability to magnify our numbers bigger than they actually are nowadays. You know, like, I guess that's the best way to describe it is we're now better interconnected, therefore we seem bigger than we actually are.
All right, so last up, let's go with the erasable D&D 5th edition character boards.
Okay.
A solid character board with a dry erase surface and rotating dials to make tracking stats easier.
You know, I'm not usually a fan of these physical things, but this amuses me terribly, and I'm trying to figure out why.
I don't know. I think it's kind of cool in a weird way. I don't know if I could use it, but I think it's kind of just, I think what it is I can appreciate the thought that has gone into this above all else.
Well, I like the idea. This is something I've been told about on multiple occasions. Most people can't design character sheets worth beans. And we've been trying to design the perfect character sheet for, what, decades now?
Yes.
And you always think you got it, and then you find something that you missed, and then you're... I think it's one of the great fights of gaming, is to get a character sheet that's within 1 to 2 pages that doesn't feel like you're missing something.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like the idea of having a vulnerable thing with your little list at the bottom, and it looks like a placemat.
No, I do, and I love the little counters for the hit points, the little reels. That's what that's for.
Yeah, I think that's what's really making, you know, tickling my gizmo tear side. It's like, cheers.
I mean, they've reached their goal, so that's cool. Man, this is one of those things that I don't think I could purchase myself, but I give them kudos for the design.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it looks, you know, it looks good. It looks like it's functional. It looks like there's a, is that a spell sheet, you know, like an additional sheet that can go with it?
Yeah, there's like a sheet with little dials at the bottom, and you can choose how many spells you have left over.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I give them total points, because this is one of the big bitches that I have with my character sheets. Like, it's like, you know, I'm very old school. I've used scotch tape over areas where that I'm going to write on a lot.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, still works, people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because it's old school doesn't mean it doesn't work. But in this day and age, people just print out new character sheets.
When you go to a hobby shop, you're probably going to use a lot of stuff there. Not how it was originally intended, but they make great gaming material.
Yeah. So, okay. So yeah, this, I mean, honestly, I do appreciate this. Unfortunately, $25 per sheet, per board. I guess for if you were only going to buy one board, yeah, maybe.
I'll be blunt. If I actually did more tabletop gaming and less Roll20 gaming, I probably would pick one up, but I can't justify the cost.
Yeah. $50 though for both the character sheet and the spell sheet.
Yeah, that is pretty pricey. Like, I'd almost want to buy them in bulk because, well, again, if you do this, you almost want to, this would be great at like a con or something, you know?
I'm sorry. I take that back. It's $50 just for the character sheet, $30 for the spell sheet, $80 for the character board and spell sheet.
Oh, okay. They just priced themselves out of the market right there. But then again, obviously, I must not be saying right because they made their money. So well done.
Well, you know, again, for a single person, they're like, this is what I use to track my character stuff. You know, $80 for something you're going to use a lot?
Yep.
Not that big of a deal. It's a drop in the bucket. I mean, let's face it, the rule books are what? Typical rule books now are $30, $40, $50.
Yes.
So this is not really unheard of.
No. Yeah, this would. I like the idea. I think it's a really well-designed sheet. But yeah, it's another one of these ones where you wouldn't say no if you got it like a present, but I don't know if I'd want to buy it, if that makes any sense. At the same time, I am grinning from ear to ear as I look at the thing. So. Yeah. Okay. Bundle holding.
Yeah, the only problem is that he talks about the fact that shipping is high.
Yeah, well, for good reason. You're looking.
He can only churn out about 3 per day.
Oh, is he making them like old school?
I have no idea how he's making them. He just makes this notice that I can churn out about 3 per day. I've set my ship date to November to give me plenty of extra time in case the project gets overfunded. Smart. I like that. I appreciate that. I appreciate the fact that he's even said, hey, this is what I can do per day. This is my, you know, my amount.
Yeah, take it or leave it. Yeah, no, I give him full credit for setting up his parameters before he starts. And
oh, because he has 88 backers. So yeah. Just by his own calculation, 88 backers divided by 3 is a month.
Yes.
Of time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, because so that's smart. He gave himself to November. He, you know, I appreciate that. This is, you know, he was at least thoughtful about it. I could appreciate that.
This would be one I'd almost want to watch after it's funded just to see how well it goes, because it might be a good, either it's amazing, it would be a textbook example of how to run it, or a cautionary tale that it doesn't, how not to. You know, it's one of those ones you almost want to revisit after the fact just to see how it goes.
Yeah, but it's weird because 40 of the backers of this camp, so he really only has 48 that he has to make, because 40 of them just want his custom D20.
Well, that's a good sign.
Yeah, so that's even better, because 48 divided by 3, that's 16 days. You can churn that out easily in a month.
Well, what's the old saying? Doing what you love is good, making a profit is better.
Yeah. All right, let's do the bundle of holdings to get the heck out of Dodge. So first up, we have, with 20 days left to go, we have Mithras. The Mithras bundle of holding, which is kind of cool. I've never really played this, have you?
Sorry, man, I'm not familiar with this at all, but it looks amusing. I like what I see.
Yeah, and so apparently they are funding the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the EFFF.
Right on. That's always a good sign. Curious about this, but this would be one of those ones I'd love to hear somebody rant about this just so we get an understanding.
The only reason I might buy this is just because they, in their bonus collection, they have Mythic Rome. That might be an interesting read.
Yeah, well, we're both suckers for Rome and history and so forth. And we consider it to be one of the... Well, there's been many a game done in Rome. I don't think we've ever hit the iconic Roman game, if that makes any sense.
Well, I think the thing, especially with Rome, something like Rome, it's always interesting to get other points of view about what they think Rome was.
Absolutely.
You know, because... You can read all the history you want. You can watch all the miniseries you want. By the way, I do recommend the old HBO series Rome, even though it was not quite correct.
Confession time. I own the DVDs, and honestly, you know what it felt like? Fred and Barney as Romans.
Fred and Barney are Romans?
Like, you look at their actions, you like their responses, and yeah, the two main characters remind me of Fred and Barney. From the Flintstones.
There we go. I was trying to think.
You know, they obviously are a lot darker in a lot of ways and stuff there, but it's... I always love the main character and how flippant he is. You know, he's a nice, friendly guy who's actually an absolute monster.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite lines from that show was the one where, you know... Julius Caesar is like talking. I forget which character he's talking to, but it's like he was taught. One of the characters was like, shouldn't those guys be, you know, you do something with those guys? She says, any other two guys? Yes. But they found my eagle, and then they survived a storm that no one else survived. They have gods on their side, and I don't really want to fuck with someone who has God on their side right now.
Oh, absolutely. There were a lot of great little scenes from that. Like, I'll give them full kudos for that series. You know, it was a fun little series for sure. You know, for sure.
Yeah.
My personal favorite is when he's there to kill Cicero, and he's incredibly friendly about it. Like, hey, do you mind if I have a peach? Thanks, man. I really appreciate it. You know.
Yeah.
You know, and even after he kills him, he says he was the nicest guy I ever met. Really nice. A lot more than you expect. Like, it was such a freaking disconnect.
Yeah. So, all right. So next up, we have...
I think anybody knows Roman history knows that. One last thing. Just a buddy of mine actually picked up the Feng Shui bundle of holding. I'll let you guys know once we finally start running it how it goes.
All right. Cool.
And, you know, because I'm a sucker for Kung Fu Action Theater, just like everybody else. Plus, it's written by Robin D. Laws, the same guy I recommended for Hamlet Hit Points. So,
yeah.
It'll be fun to see where it
and
goes.
And it's still ongoing, by the way.
Yeah.
So, that's cool. And again, they're funding the National Film Preservation Foundation.
Yeah, I'm. You know, I know it's probably the most, I don't know, self-interested charity, but I like movies. I think I say it to some.
Well.
And it'd be fun to see some of these things return.
It's not only that, but it's just preserving film. Because it's like, people don't realize, like, if you ever watch Metropolis.
Yeah.
You know, the early... It's like even the versions that we see of that aren't the full version.
No.
We're missing huge sections of it because it just got destroyed. It just disintegrated, if you will.
My personal favorite is there's this guy who, James Rolfe, who a lot of people know as the angry video game nerd. He has a life's quest to grab every single version of King Kong and make the complete version of King Kong. One that has all the different as many cuts as they have without too much missing footage.
Hmm.
It's kind of his white whale. And I wonder if he ever finished it, because if he did, I'd buy that for sure. So. You know, even if it was just for once, and even if it the scenes didn't add much to it, like, it wouldn't be the first time that you had scenes and suddenly it's not as good.
Yeah, you know, I've definitely watched movies where it's like, here's the director's cut. It's like, fuck, you know what? I think the director is wrong. Honestly.
I will state for the record, I have nothing but the highest respect for George Lucas as a person and even as a designer. But sometimes you got to learn when to let it go.
Oh, don't get me started on that. It's like, you know, I do not understand. Yeah, I still have the VHS tapes for the original Star Wars trilogy that are not been CGI enhanced.
Same here, man. Same here.
So.
And getting rid of them anytime soon. There's a reason I own a VHS.
To watch that. It's definitely not to watch the Star Wars Christmas special, right?
Yeah! All I can say is Lumpy sends his regards. Although that would be funny as hell. That's the one thing they should have had in the freaking sequels, have Lumpy show up just once. As an adult, just to piss off everybody. People, you know, of the old series people, the new series, everybody. But again, I'm an evil man that way. And plus, the sequels needed more aliens. I'll say it right now.
Yeah, I have I've decided that, well, Star Wars and specifically Disney does not deserve my money. So
I understand completely. Again, you. This has been the year for me that a lot of things I really liked got destroyed. And oddly enough, Star Wars is not one of them yet. However, don't get me started about Reboot.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of my favorite science fiction shows of all time, and I'm going to put a pin in it for another time.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I. Because who did the reboot? Was that a Netflix series?
Reboot was the first CGI TV show that was
originally
done.
No. I mean, the reboot. Was that a Netflix series, I think?
It was a Netflix series, and essentially it's...
Horrible.
It's right. Basically... I'm sure it's probably... There's probably a closer analogy, but essentially it's Power Rangers, where you get to watch the users. To the point where in episode 10... They build the user, and he's some tubby middle-aged guy because he's living in the parents' basement.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, troll the people that originally bought your product.
No, but definitely the original series, I remember watching it when it was on ABC, and then did the Cartoon Network continue it at one point is what happened?
It was done actually by a Canadian channel called YTV, where they did the third season. They weren't actually held by the censors, for lack of a better term. Like, it's still not, like, a horrific series or anything like that. It's still meant for kids. But yeah. They did one of the most amazing things. They took a kid, they made him a guardian, they made him fail, and they made him unbelievably bitter because of it. And for a kid's cartoon, like, when the kid finally shows back and he's built, like, a brick, well, for lack of a better term, shithouse, and to the guy who basically destroyed his life, and they have the epic clash. Yeah, it's 90s CGI movie, but it has so much, like, it's the same thing like watching Empire Strikes Back. There's so much emotion that you can forgive a lot, even if they're not the greatest, you know, fighting or the greatest, you know, art in the world, because you're invested in the story, which is the most important thing you can do with something like this.
Yeah.
But I'm backing away because I could talk for hours.
Yeah, Reboot was definitely one of those TV series from the 80s that, it's odd because that set this foundation for so much CGI that came later.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. In my humble opinion, they should have spent the money and just did, like, the equivalent of an HD release and just cleaned up the graphics for the first four seasons and saw if there was a market still.
Yeah.
But that's my opinion.
All right. So let's finish up this Bender hole and get the hell out of here. How about that?
Agreed. Well, I guess the Yankees are coming.
Yeah, we have the Hero Kids is the other one.
Yep.
Which is basically, it says, Hero Kids brings DRM-free, non-watermarked PDF ebooks featuring Hero Kids, a fast and fun introductory tabletop RPG perfect for the kids 4 to 10, just getting interested into RPGs, which I always think is a plus.
In my humble opinion, in the last 3 to 4 years, there's been a lot of attempts to build a kids game, and I welcome them for it. We need a better gateway drug when it comes to getting people into the hobby.
Never mind the fact that at age 10, let's see, 10, what grade is that in the U.S.?
Four?
Fourth or fifth?
Yeah, about that.
I was already playing D&D at that point. I don't mean that to be cruel, but it's like, I really do tell people, it's like, I wasn't playing it well, but I was playing AD&D in the third and fourth grade. And it's funny because there's a reason that when I took standardized tests later in life, I mean, we're talking like when I was 12, I was reading on a college level.
Yeah, that's kind of one of those weird side effects of gaming, especially when you have to wade through all the stuff here.
You know, I was doing mathematics at a high school graduate level, you know, what they considered the minimum, you know, the requirements to graduate high school already. You know, unfortunately, my spelling was in a fourth grade level, but that's another story.
Man, dude, I've used trigonometry in gaming before I used it in freaking math class.
Oh God, just because of space games, it's like, yeah, I can determine distance from three dimensional points, and people would look at me funny, you know?
What? Oh, dude, you want to maximize your fireballs? Duh.
Well, no, I'm just saying, you know, like in, with star charts, you know, when you have three-dimensional points, you have to determine the distance between those two sets of XYZ coordinates.
Absolutely.
And it's like, I could do the math already. And people are like, what are you doing? I'm determining distance. What? That doesn't make any sense. It's math. Come on.
It's space is 3D. Get used to the idea.
So there's this one, and they are, they're... Clearly, because it's a kid's game, they're funding reading is fundamental.
Yep. That's important. I like that. I support getting the next generation to read pretty hard because, well, that's how you get better, more gamers.
Just get better people. I mean, I don't... It's weird that in this day and age where people still don't know how to read, which really strikes me as funny. Just from the standpoint of the fact that here we are, kids these days have smartphones or tablets. How do you not know how to read?
Yeah, that's
kids don't.
Dude, I was reading stuff when I was very young that I probably shouldn't have. Just because that's how I got my game, man. Like, I did a lot of reading when I was younger. And I still do, because reading is fun.
I can think as a kid I was reading a lot of stuff that I really shouldn't have been, but that's another story.
Fair enough.
It's funny. When I was a kid, there were a set of woods that people used to dump their vehicles out of, and let's just say, as a kid, I found a lot of pornographic material out there.
Learned somewhere.
Kids will never know the joys of that.
Well, they don't need to anymore. They got the internet.
Oh, I know, but you know what I mean. It's kind of funny.
The anticipation of the hunt. And if you have any question whatsoever, see Stranger Things and you'll get a basic idea.
Yeah. All right, why don't we finish up this episode? How's that sound?
Sounds to me. It's time to get to the chopper.
So if you have anything you want to tell us, go ahead and send us... an email at info@rpgcircus.com. Go to the Facebook page or our homepage, and there is a link to a voicemail app that you can record a voicemail message and send it to us. No one has done that in a super, super long time. And I know there are listeners out there, so somebody send us something.
Absolutely. And again, if you had a war campaign of some way, shape, or form, tell us all about it. Tell us what worked. Tell us what didn't. Tell us how fun it was or how fun it wasn't. We're curious.
Yeah. So there's that. And, of course, you can always post a message on either Google+ or Facebook or even a comment on our homepage, because I try to answer all of them or at least forward them or do something with them. I don't try to leave people hanging. Even if the answer is, I have no idea. At least you'll know.
Indeed.
And with that, I think we're going to call it even. And wow, we have actually talked for almost 2 hours.
Yeah.
Is that possible?
You know, I think we liked our military history, military games. That's all I'm going to say.
You know, we honestly, I know what it is. I like flapping my lips.
A podcast, you're entitled.
All right. So we hope to see everyone in 2 weeks where we will have a new topic. And because of the we're using Trillo right now to keep track of topics, we have a list. So we will have something next in the next 2 weeks. So that will be good. So we'll see everyone in about 2 weeks. Does that sound good to you?
Sounds good to me.
All right. So until then, good gaming.
RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.